Hello, and welcome to Robbinsdale Revisited. I'm Pete Ritchie, the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. In this episode, we follow the extraordinary life of Adelaide Walker Robbins, teacher, writer, Civil War nurse, and one of the women that helped shape early Minnesota communities from the frontier era to the modern age. Long before Robbinsdale carried her family name, Adelaide was tending wounded Union soldiers in Army hospitals during the Civil War, working alongside her mother and sister in some of the conflict's darkest days. Through her own words, letters, newspaper accounts, and family memories, this episode traces a life that stretched from the muddy railroad towns and pioneer settlements to the rise of Minneapolis and the founding of Robbinsdale itself. Along the way, we meet the people closest to her, including her husband, Andrew Robbins, and her famous brother, Thomas Barlow Walker, better known to history as T.B. Walker. But at the center of the story is Adelaide herself, intelligent, determined, deeply patriotic. So join me and Crystal Boyd as we explore the life of Adelaide Walker Robbins. Adelaide Walker Robbins lived long enough to see Minneapolis transformed from frontier settlement and muddy railroad town to a modern state of cities, churches, schools, and suburbs. But the remarkable thing about her story is that she was never just watching history happen around her. Again and again, she just seemed to step directly into it. When Adelaide Walker Robbins died in Robbinsdale on June 25, 1929, at the age of 81, newspapers across Minnesota remembered her as the widow of Andrew B. Robbins, the founder of Robbinsdale, and the sister of Minneapolis lumber baron Thomas B. Walker. But the deeper story was much larger than that. Adelaide Robbins had already lived several lifetimes before Robbinsdale ever carried her family name. She was born Adelaide Julia Walker in 1847 in Xenia, Ohio. Her early childhood carried more hardship than the polished family histories sometimes let on. According to Who's Who Among Minnesota Women, her father, Piap Bayless Walker, headed west during the gold rush and never returned. Family tradition held that he and his wagon train died of cholera somewhere along the trail. Her mother, Anstice Barlow Walker, moved the family to Berea, Ohio, so her daughters could receive an education. Adelaide entered Baldwin University, today known as Baldwin-Wallace University, when she was only 12 years old. She quickly developed a reputation for brilliance in mathematics, reportedly the youngest student in her class, and the prize winner for the highest standing over two consecutive years. It was an unusual distinction for a young woman in the 1850s when higher education for women was still rare enough to draw some attention. Then the Civil War interrupted everything. Years later, Adelaide recalled sitting with her sister Helen while their mother read casualty reports from the newspapers. As the lists of wounded soldiers grew longer, the family decided they could not simply stand aside. They traveled to Columbus, Ohio, and enlisted in a hospital where the women of the family became volunteer nurses. At only 14 years old, Adelaide Walker was helping care for wounded Union soldiers at Camp Chase and Tripler General Hospitals. She and her sister handled dressings, linens, diets, and what were called home letters, writing correspondence for injured and probably illiterate soldiers that were too weak to write themselves. She later received an honorable discharge signed by Dorothea Dix, one of the most important organizers of Union nursing during the war. The spirit of service stayed with her the rest of her life. After the war ended in 1865, the family moved west again, this time to St. Anthony, the settlement that would later become part of Minneapolis. Adelaide taught in rural schools before becoming a teacher and eventually a principal at Marcy School in Minneapolis. It was there that she met a young railroad employee named Andrew B. Robbins. At the time, Andrew Robbins worked for the St. Paul Pacific Railroad as an accountant, ticket agent, and telegrapher. The railroad office sat in St. Anthony before later moving across the river to Minneapolis. According to family recollections, Robbins would walk across the railroad bridge just to visit Adelaide at her family home. Their courtship sounded almost impossibly romantic. Adelaide later reminisced about skating with Andrew on the frozen Mississippi River near Nicollet Island and playing long games of chess in the Walker family home. On one skating outing, they discovered afterward that the temperature had dropped to 40 below. They married on March 25th, 1869. A year later, they moved to Willmar, where the railroad had just extended its line. Andrew Robbins became a station agent again at what was considered the furthest western point on the route. In many ways, they arrived before the town itself did. The Robbins family built one of the first substantial homes in Willmar, helped organize the First Presbyterian Church, and became deeply involved in the civic and business life of the young settlement. Andrew founded the Bank of Willmar and entered the machinery business and partnered with the town's first general store. Adelaide, meanwhile, helped build the social and spiritual framework of the community. And yet, life on the frontier was never easy. After 14 years in Willmar, the Robbins family packed up and prepared to return east. Their belongings were all set out to be stored in a railroad station and ready for shipment. Then the station burned down and everything they owned was lost. Still, they rebuilt. The family moved to Merriam Park in St. Paul in 1882, where they again became charter members of the Presbyterian Church community. Andrew Robbins later entered state politics and served as Minnesota state senator before turning his attention to a stretch of land just northwest of Minneapolis. In 1890, the Robbins family moved permanently to the community that would soon bear their name, Robbinsdale. The stories surrounding those early days in Robbinsdale often focus on Andrew Robbins laying out streets and developing property, but Adelaide's role was just as significant. According to family histories, the couple planted carloads of trees across the new suburb and built many of the early homes themselves. Even after Andrew's death in 1910, Adelaide reportedly continued supervising the platting and construction projects into her late 70s. And she somehow found time for everything else. She wrote poetry and prose for magazines. She lectured and traveled. She crossed Europe twice, journeying through the Panama Canal during an era when international travel still felt dangerous and rare. She belonged to the Tourist Club, the Women's Relief Corps, the Daughters of the American Revolution, and numerous church organizations connected to Westminster Presbyterian Church and the Congregational Church in Robbinsdale. She served as chaplain and later vice president of the Civil War Nurses Association. She attended Grand Army of the Republic encampments well into old age. She memorized large portions of the Bible and remained intellectually curious throughout her life. In fact, only a week before her final illness, she attended a lecture at the University of Minnesota to hear a noted scholar, Richard Burton, speak. Her family life carried both joy and sorrow. She and Andrew had several daughters, including Amy Robbins Ware, who followed the family tradition of volunteer nursing by serving in the American Expeditionary Force in France during World War I. Newspapers in 1929 pointed out the extraordinary continuity, three generations of women in one family serving as volunteer nurses across two wars. But Adelaide also endured terrible losses. Two children, Harland and Helen, died in childhood. Her daughter Amy died only weeks before Adelaide herself passed away. Andrew B. Robbins had already been gone nearly 20 years. People who knew Adelaide Robbins personally described her as intelligent, cultured, demanding, and deeply determined. One family recollection joked that Andrew Robbins possessed the patience of Job. While he was waiting for Adelaide and their five daughters to get ready to leave the house, he would pace back and forth on the front porch. She loved flowers and knew both their botanical and common names by memory. And perhaps these details say something more important about her, because Adelaide Walker Robbins belonged to a generation that often disappears into the background of history books, the women who organized churches, taught schools, planted trees, nursed soldiers, preserved culture, wrote letters, raised families, and quietly built the communities, while others received the headlines. But in Robbinsdale, her imprint never really disappeared. She arrived in Minnesota when Minneapolis was still a frontier village. She helped build Willmar before it was truly a town. She helped shape Robbinsdale before it was a suburb. and by the time she died in 1929, she had spent nearly 70 years actively participating in the civic, educational, religious, and cultural life of Minnesota, not simply witnessing history, but building it. We should talk a little bit more about her famous brother. T.B. Walker, born Thomas Barlow Walker in 1840, was one of the most influential business figures in early Minnesota history and the older brother of Adelaide Walker Robbins. After arriving in Minnesota in 1860, Walker built a fortune in the lumber industry by surveying and purchasing vast tracts of northern pine forest. His knowledge of the land and aggressive business ventures helped make him one of the wealthiest men in America during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Beyond lumber, he invested heavily in Minneapolis industries, banks, transportation, real estate, and he helped transform Minneapolis from a frontier town into a major commercial city. He also played a major role in developing communities such as St. Louis Park and the town of Walker, Minnesota, which still bears his name. Walker was equally known for his philanthropy and passion for the arts. He helped establish the Minneapolis Public Library system and spent decades assembling one of the finest private art collections in the country. Beginning in the 1870s, visitors could tour galleries inside his Minneapolis mansion where he displayed paintings, sculptures, rare glass, and artifacts from around the world. His collection eventually became the foundation for the famed Walker Art Center. Although remembered as a hard-driving businessman with strong opinions, Walker also believed deeply in public education, culture, and civic improvement, leaving a lasting mark on Minnesota long after his death in 1928. We are fortunate at the Robbinsdale Historical Society because we've got a few of Adelaide Walker Robbins' letters in our collection. Crystal Boyd is going to read this one that details her Civil War experience to relatives back in Ohio.
My dear Mrs. Hunter, when my daughter, Mrs. Amy Robbins Ware, returned from a visit to Berea, Ohio, I was thrilled by the account she gave of the way my mother's memory is still cherished in my old hometown. She lives in the hearts of the people as the embodiment of the spirit of Joan of Arc as well as of Clara Barton. She will always be remembered as a leader who was an outstanding advocate of loyalty, patriotism, and service to one's country, a woman far in advance of the women of her day and a generation of women. In the early days of the Civil War, our spacious home became the center for organizing and directing war relief work. Here the college girls came to make the flag for the company of soldiers going out from Berea, including many college boys, almost every one destined to make the supreme sacrifice. A premonition of this seemed to pervade the vast assembly gathered on the village green around the raised platform. On this, my sister stood as she gave the flag with words of encouragement, blessing, and farewell to our boys as they marched away to the soul-stirring strains of martial music. Even after all the intervening years, I cannot think with composure of the eventful busy days that followed. Promptly, we organized our unit of the Wide Awake Club, branches of which were formed in many places for making hospital supplies and other patriotic activities. My earliest definite war relief work was as first president of this group of young people. We also entered heartily into the work of the great sanitary fair held at Cleveland. Delegations from Baldwin University made the 14-mile trip to that city to contribute our share of work for that cause. Imagine a lightly built circular structure the size of Barnum and Bailey's largest tent, profusely decorated with festoons of hemlock greens and well-lighted. The entire wall space separated into booths for the sale of an endless variety of articles manufactured and homemade, all contributed for the benefit of the U.S. Sanitary Commission. Often in those days, we gathered on our beloved front porch, where the climbing roses blossomed by the door, and paused to listen as Mother read the news from the Cleveland Herald. The terrible lists of the dead in both armies seemed incredible, as did the number of carloads of wounded being sent back from the battlefields to be cared for and saved, if possible. By whom? This question faced every patriot, for surely the fields were shite to the harvest and the laborers were few. In the mid-years of the 19th century, when Union soldiers were dying for lack of care, it needed not added years nor nurses' diplomas to make the services of women skilled in the care of the sick acceptable in Army nursing service. In 64, word came that more women were needed in Army hospitals. Mother said, "We are needed and must go." Regardless of college work or home, we answered the call and were accepted for immediate service. My mother and stepfather, with their 10-year-old son, went at once to Columbus, Ohio, leaving my sister and me to close the home and follow as soon as possible. When we reached there, complete arrangements had been made and the contract signed by mother. Our first assignment was at Chase General Hospital, Camp Chase, near Columbus, Ohio. My mother, having a nurse's accredited diploma as head nurse, my sister and I as her assistants, the three constituting the entire women nursing personnel of the hospital. My stepfather, Mr. Oliver Barnes, a gentleman of wide experience as owner and manager of hotels, was recognized as specially fitted to take full charge of dining rooms and kitchens for personnel and patients. Ward masters and orderlies were chosen from the convalescents and carried much of the work of the wards. The medical staff consisted of Dr. Schultz, surgeon in charge, and assisting physicians. I very well remember Dr. Metzger, also Dr. Tipton, with his wife and two little daughters, Lizzie and Alice. Having carried my share of the work during the summer of 64, it was thought that I might be spared to return to college, as I was anxious to complete my university course. I therefore went back to Berea and registered for my junior year. However, after only 2 weeks, I was recalled to the hospital because needed. This proved a real sacrifice for me, as our family moved to Minneapolis shortly after the close of the war, and the opportunity never came again for me to take my university degree. I was absent from the hospital so short a time, it was considered as a leave of absence, and I resumed my duties at once. Dr. Schultz proved himself indeed a general in making those perfectly inadequate barracks like buildings served to care for so many till the Tripler General Hospital buildings could be rushed to completion. They were located in a beautiful grove on the banks of the Scioto River, 2 miles away. How thankful we were when this small army, physicians, patients, and workers, were moved bodily to what seemed to us such grand new quarters, there to remain till the close of the war. What a feast to our eyes, the first glimpse of that group in the grove. One full two-story building to accommodate on the first floor the spacious dining room and kitchen for convalescent patients, and a smaller suite for light diet. The large chapel with its much-appreciated melodeon occupied the entire second floor. In another structure just like it were offices and dispensary, also living quarters consisting of separate housekeeping apartments, each with its private entrance and stairway occupying 2 floors. Here were housed families of surgeons, chaplain, and head nurse. In our apartment, mother always cared for friends and relatives who came to visit patients in the hospital. I remember that my sister and I remained even at night with a mother at the bedside of her dying boy. Of the 14 one-story buildings, 12 were the separate wards, each accommodating 40 patients. The other two were in the background, one the ice house, and the other made sacred, for here must rest the mortal remains of the boys who answered the slow, sweet call that summons at last to rest in the rendezvous in the West, till friends came to claim them, or they were laid away unclaimed. When news came of the fall of Richmond and the surrender of Lee, we knew the cruel war was over. And a spirit not of riotous mirth, but of exalted thanksgiving, settled over all. Then came the sudden transition to sorrow when the nation bowed in grief over the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. All who could be spared were allowed to go to Columbus, where the body of that great man lay in state in the rotunda of the Capitol, the whole building draped in black with Ohio mourns over the gates. The unbroken line of grief-stricken people passed day and night before the flower-banked catafalque, where lay the mortal remains of the great commander-in-chief, under whose wise and gentle leadership had been saved a nation one and indivisible, and a race had been freed from bondage. It was a sad and silent company that rode back to Tripler Hospital in the ambulance that day. Yet we must go on with our task, for there were many sick and disabled to be cared for. So many joys and so many sorrows have filled the years that have come and gone since that day. I cannot recall the details of the busy, hurried summer of 1865. Of the many patients in the hospital at this time, those who had homes must be made ready for the eagerly anticipated journey. Those who had no homes must also be prepared for their journey to the hospitals that were to be permanently maintained. It required months to complete these arrangements. When our work was over, we were all weary and worn, but we had the satisfaction of having ministered to the best of our ability to those who had suffered their lives in a cause they held just. I remember my sister and I asked for our release before Mother that we might go to Berea and open the home that had been closed during our hospital service. Our whole family had volunteered, and it was a matter of great thanksgiving that all had been given strength to carry through to the end of this strenuous undertaking. You have asked me how I was paid for my nursing work. It is my recollection that my compensation was always included with my mother's. That having been agreed upon in arrangements made before I reached Camp Chase in the early summer of 1864. I know that it was a matter of comparatively little interest to me at the time, as the sacrifice I was making was greater than could be paid for, and the real purpose of all of us was service rather than compensation. Our family had moved to St. Anthony, Minnesota in 1866. There, in 1869, I was married to Andrew B. Robbins, who had served in Company A, 8th Minnesota Volunteers, through the Civil War. Our household goods were all burned in a disastrous fire in 1871. To my great dismay, my hospital keepsakes were included in this loss. My official discharge from Army Nursing Service, which I had received upon completing my work at Tripler Hospital in 1865, and a very large picture of Tripler General Hospital. All I have left is a photograph of the medical staff of Tripler Hospital, Drs. Schultz, Knight, Tipton, Metzger, and two assistants. I trust that this long account of personal experiences may be justified by the fact that so few remain who can give authentic account of those unwritten pages of Civil War history. A true record of those days surely should be preserved. Out of 45 names on the 1927 to 1928 roster of our National Association of Army Nurses of the Civil War, 16 have answered the last call, more than one-third of our remaining membership. We look across the sunset to those we have lost, already outnumbered by those who have crossed. Please accept my warm personal regards for yourself and extend to Mr. Newton my sincere appreciation of his interest in my long-ago service record. Sincerely yours, Adelaide J. Walker Robbins, Robbinsdale, Minnesota. P.S. In reading over what I have written, I find that I have not made it clear that it was Dr. Knight who, after I completed a special assignment early in the summer of 1865, released me from active duty late in August. It was then my sister and I went back to Berea, opened our home, and made it ready for the return of the family so long absent. This may not be important, but I wish to make it clear why my discharge was granted earlier than my mother's. A.J.W.R.
We are so fortunate that so many of Adelaide Robbins' letters, papers, and photographs have survived into the 21st century. In some of the earliest photographs, we see Adelaide seated next to Andrew B. Robbins. It's probably the late 1860s. Andrew B. Robbins has a big old beard. Later on, he goes down to a bushy mustache. And by the time you get to the early 1900s, he's almost always wearing a goatee. Adelaide tends to wear dark clothes in all of these photos. We can't really guess the color. Could be black, could be purple. But I think that she was wearing darker colors because she's always pictured out of doors. Often she's trimming a bush or kneeling in some dirt. They tend to be candid photos rather than the posed photographs that we associate with that time period. In one of my favorite pictures, Andrew B. Robbins and Adelaide are standing in front of a great big lilac bush, and they're looking down at a book, or at least Andrew is pretending to read a book, and Adelaide's sort of looking up the camera with a little bit of a smile. I don't know what they're reading. Could be a Bible, could be a gardening manual. After 1910, after the death of her husband, Adelaide certainly had her fingers in the business, although Edith was the noted executor of the estate. Adelaide was active and she was traveling. She went to Europe twice. She went through the Panama Canal and she would write long articles for the Tourist Club about her travels. She would also write essays on art for T.B. Walker's publications, and she wrote a little poetry that was published in countless magazines. She didn't always use her own name, so some of these things are hard to find, but she was a noted writer, among other things. When she passed away in 1929, the amount of coverage her death got sort of surprises me. It was front page in every other paper in Minnesota. Often there were stories about her pioneer days. There were retellings of her courtship days. She must have spent a fair amount of time talking to reporters over the years, and they just pulled out all the old stories that they could find on Adelaide Robbins. Just a month or two before she died, she went to a Grand Army of the Republic encampment in Michigan and delivered a speech there. We know that she was involved with all sorts of intellectual pursuits over at the University of Minnesota. She was certainly involved in the life of Robbinsdale to the extent that she was overseeing some of the projects, some of the houses being built, some of the real estate transactions. It's hard to say exactly how much pull she had in that organization, and I'm trying to imagine the sharing of responsibility between the three Robbins women that were in Robbinsdale at the time. But she had a remarkable life and certainly left a lasting imprint on our city.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale. Ooh.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
The end.